The literary magazine Lapham's Quarterly was founded in 2007. Over the past 2 years, Lapham's Quarterly has undergone a dramatic transformation. In late 2023, it put aside its print publication, put it on a hiatus, citing severe financial pressures and an inhospitable climate for serious magazines. The death of its founder, Lewis Lapham, in 2024 further challenged its trajectory. Earlier this year, Bard announced that it is back. Lapham's Quarterly, a full relaunch, is happening under Bard College's Hannah Arendt Center, reviving its website and podcast and planning a return to print as well. Moving forward, the Quarterly's future likely rests on a model of digital and print, increased institutional support and expanded outreach, especially through Bard's infrastructure and its prison education initiative. We speak with two people now who have had long ties to Lapham's Quarterly, as well as Bard College. Francine Prose is the author of 22 works of fiction, including the highly acclaimed The Vixen, Mr. Monkey, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, and Blue Angel, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. She is a distinguished writer in residence here at Bard College and the editor-at-large of Lapham's Quarterly. Welcome. So nice to have you here.
Thank you, Joe. Good
always,
to be here.
Always a pleasure to speak with you. Donovan Hone is with us as well. He is the author of The Inner Coast Essays and Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea. The mind wanders, does it not? And we are also proud to say he is director of creative writing at Wayne State University in Detroit, acting editor at Lapham's Quarterly, and an absolute delight to welcome Donovan to the program as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I know there's been some back and forth. Do I have your positions of editors and acting editors and executive editors and editors at large? Is that correct as of the moment?
It is. You got it.
Excellent. Yeah. Good. All right. I didn't know if there had been a new batch of business cards that had been printed that I wasn't that I wasn't aware of. Yesterday at this conference, the two of you spoke along with Charles Baxter about Dark Charisma. Give us a sense of how that fits into your work and what you spoke about yesterday.
Yes. So, Charles Baxter, a wonderful novelist, essayist, also my former professor when I was in grad school. And he was among the writers I reached out to when Francine and I were relaunching Lapham's Quarterly this past summer. Francine and I had a conversation up here in the Hudson Valley in which I said, what if we did a kind of book club? And I remember that you seemed delighted by this idea. And because Moby Dick was the last book, Lewis loved Moby Dick. It probably, if he had to choose one favorite novel, it would have been that one. He first experienced it as a six-year-old, having it read to him by his mother. And it was the last book he was reading as he approached the grave. What would be the last book you would choose to accompany you? So it felt like Moby Dick was the book we were going to spend time with. And the idea was to use the Lapham's Quarterly podcast to invite on historians and writers to talk with me about a chapter of their choosing. Francine spoke with me about chapter one, Loomings. And Charlie spoke with me about chapter nine, the sermon delivered by Father Mapple. Charlie has an essay about Ahab and the idea, the politics of charisma. So in Charlie's formulation, dark charisma, we get the idea of charisma from religion. In Christianity, you're a kind of holy figure if you're charismatic. Dark charisma, in Charlie's analysis, is a kind of figure that has became familiar to us in the 20th century and maybe once again in the 21st, of having elements that are charismatic but are being put towards a kind of wounded, disfigured end.
So Trump as Ahab.
Look, we sometimes tell it slant at Lapham's Quarterly, but yes, in talking about Ahab, we may be talking about our current president as well.
Yeah, it did come up in a kind of covert way.
Yeah.
So, so many things do, I assume, at Lapham's Quarterly, coming up at a way. Francine, what is, has this meant to you of reviving this and bringing Lapham's Quarterly back from the grave, really?
Well, it's huge. I mean, Lewis was my editor at Harper's for many years, and he was a great, great editor. I mean, encouraged me to do things I wouldn't have done otherwise and to go further writing things that I wouldn't have gone that far. And then he was my editor at Lapham's Quarterly. And I guess in the last 10 or 15 years of Lewis's life, we became friends in addition to working together. And about twice a year, we would have lunch at his favorite kind of weird restaurant, Nick and Tony's in Gramercy, which he liked because he could go outside and smoke. It was on the ground floor. And at every one of these lunches, Bard would come up and he would ask me how my classes were and so forth. And the idea that Lapham's Quarterly might wind up at Bard began to generate during those lunches because Lewis's values and Bard's values were very similar. I mean, liberal education, literature, the importance of history, the importance of looking back at the past to understand the present. And he had a huge respect for Bard and for Leon Botstein and was always asking me. And I think one of his dreams, which I don't think maybe Donovan knows hasn't quite been realized yet, was to have all of the back issues of the Quarterly put in the libraries of the prisons that are served by the Bard Prison Initiative. Mm. So that kept coming up and coming up. So, and you know, it's something that I hope will happen today if it someday.
I think it's going to.
It's going to?
Yeah.
So
as you all are discussing Dark Charisma yesterday afternoon, how does that fit in overall to a conference about joy?
Joy, I think, is the antidote to Dark Charisma. That's where I wanted to go with it. If in Moby Dick, Charles Baxter presented Father Mapple as an example of light charisma, a leader who is giving something through his sermon to his congregants, but it's an act of generosity and ultimately humility. For me, the most important figure in Moby Dick is Ishmael, who is a common sailor, as he says many times in the first chapter. He's lowly in his station, and there's a camaraderie, and he speaks about woe, and as a kind of a companion to joy, and I think the two are inseparable. And he's also ultimately a figure of a kind of he's saved by love. Actually, he's saved by his friend, deep friendship, his love of Queequeg in that novel, and it's Queequeg's coffin that rescues him. So I think that's my answer: is joy is the antidote.
Francine?
Yeah. Well, I also felt that there was something joyful in the experience of being able to talk about books in general and Moby Dick in particular to that audience in that room. I mean, I was before it began, I was a little afraid of being like the Debbie Downer at the Joy Conference, because it seemed to me so clear that there was so much more dark charisma around than light charisma. But partly the audience's response with saying, you know, there's plenty of light charisma, you just have to pay more attention, and so it was very heartening, and I was very, very glad and very honored and happy to have been part of it.
Do you find it difficult to find that light charisma on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah.
But I think for me, I also shared the closing of James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues, which is a kind of sermon, but in music. And for me, it's been this strange thing to reconcile in my mind. It is a dark time, but the work that we've been doing on Lapham's Quarterly, this collaboration with Bard, getting to work with Francine, whom I edited once back in the 90s, it's been some of the most joyful experiences of my career. And I felt that when we arrived at this conference, there was music. This feels like not just a conference about joy, it feels like it's a joyful conference. And that joy is an expression of freedom, actually, in and of itself.
Yeah, the last few paragraphs of James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues, which Donovan read from and talked about yesterday, really is about art as a means of salvation, which, if I believe in anything, I certainly believe in that. And I felt that that was very much in the air and in the conversation yesterday, which again was heartening and joyful.
Do the two of you find joy in your work, in your writing, in your art?
Sometimes. it's hard. I mean, I don't know about you. You're more prolific than I am. I'm slow. But I do it for a reason. I do think it's akin to the reasons why in Baldwin's stories, Sonny, who is a pianist, plays the piano. It becomes this, it feels like a kind of a necessary way of being alive. It's what he's that's the language in there is that Sonny fills the air with life, with music. And when it's going well, that's what writing feels like.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. I mean, there are good days and bad days.
Sure.
I mean, the bad days, there's this great William Burroughs quote, which I like, where he talked about the temptation to tear your work up into little tiny pieces and throw it into somebody else's waste paper basket. So, and I know those days. But there's also, the day or the moment when you find, like, the perfect sentence, or even, you know, on a very technical level, you thought you needed 10 words to say something, and it turns out you only need one word if you just find the right word. And those are very joyful experiences. I mean, I actually hear myself talking to myself and going, like, yeah, when that happens. So that's very, and if there weren't joy in it, I mean, if it were pure torture, I don't know why anyone would do it. I mean, because the rewards are small and the work is hard and long and solitary, but there are these moments of just bliss, really.
Do your students feel that joy, or do they have to take your word for it that it will come eventually?
I could talk about how much I love my students for the rest of our whole broadcast. Yeah, I mean, there are all the things that you hear about young people these days are just not true of them. They read, they love books, they get it, they write. I mean, they have to write me a weekly paper, in a 300-word paper in advance of the class. And for the first 2 weeks, I mean, now I've kind of gotten over it, but for the first 2 weeks, I was in tears because the papers were so smart and so perceptive and so beautifully written. So yeah, there's plenty of joy, and we laugh a lot in the room, so.
What are they writing about?
Well, today, this afternoon, we're doing Bartleby the Scrivener and the Metamorphosis. Which are not, come to think of it, not the most joyful stories. But there's a kind of joy that comes out of talking about it and thinking about it and thinking. Period.
So I'm teaching in Detroit in a very different kind of institution, a public research university, which Leon Botstein just spoke about. And it's grim. My university depends heavily on the funding from the National Institutes of Health and the NSF, and we're feeling it. My classroom is a sanctuary. And as with Francine's students at Bard, there's a hunger. There's a hunger for the kind of activity of the life of the mind, whether they're doing scholarship or the making of music with language, if they're studying creative writing, that's there in the classroom. And we also, we read, I've taught Moby Dick in Detroit. There's a real hunger. And there would be a huge loss. Those public universities are one of the great inventions of America, these public universities created in the 19th century. And they were always meant to not just be preparation for gainful employment. They were always meant to be a way to create a liberal, in the original sense of the word, citizenry.
So at Wayne State University in Detroit, where you teach, as you mentioned, you said it's grim. Is it obviously it's a grim situation for the college? It's a grim situation for the staff. Do the students feel it? Do you believe?
They may not be as aware of it, but the course offerings are disappearing. The class sizes are ballooning. So they've never been most of the undergraduates. This is their first time in college. So they may not be as aware of the changes as we on the faculty are, but they are suffering those changes. It's a diminishment, an impoverishment of the education that we are supposed to be providing them.
But I am happy to hear that you see it as a sanctuary.
Yes, a secular sanctuary is how I like to think about it. Yeah. And I mean, Wayne State, we had, I like to give this as an example. Robert Hayden, first Black poet laureate in America, did not come from means. It was, grew up in Detroit, was able to get an excellent education at Wayne State University. And loved the university. It was an oasis for that city, and it was highly economically accessible. And it's and that's what I'm trying to preserve in my classroom, that spirit.
You're going to be teaching this afternoon. Do you have any more work with the conference, Francine, today?
No, I have to go reread The Metamorphosis in Bartleby really fast between now and then, so no.
Well, have fun. I can't thank you both enough for being with us and for joining us for this special broadcast from Bard and from the Hannah Arendt Conference. Donovan Hoehn is the director of creative writing at Wayne State University in Detroit, and acting editor of Lapham's Quarterly. Francine Prose is the author of 22 works of fiction and a beautiful work of nonfiction, which is just, is it out in paperback yet?
Of what, 1974?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's beautiful. She is the editor-at-large at Lapham's Quarterly, and we thank both of them for being with us this morning. We'll return to WAMC right after this.